Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in. My name is Chris. You can go to the website, which is nowheretorunradio.com, and you can download all the archives for free there. And you can also go to nowheretorun.podomatic.com, and there is another way to download things there. In this episode, I'm going to be playing an interview that I just did with a friend named Derek. And Derek has a brand new show called Vision for the People, and you can go to that website at visionforthepeople.podomatic.com. And it's a really good podcast. He's a really good guy, and I think we see eye to eye in just about everything. And so I really encourage you to check out and subscribe to his show over there at visionforthepeople.podomatic.com. Also, before I play the interview, which was a really good interview, and he did a really good job of asking important and good questions, and it was just all around a good thing. But before we do that, I wanted to also recommend another podcast. My roommate, Tom Bionic from Future Quake, also came out with a new show. It's called Mighty Tom's Bible Study, and you can go to it at mightytomsbiblestudy.podomatic.com. And it's just, he does Bible studies all the time in different places and stuff, so he just started recording them, and he does a really, really good job. So I think a lot of people will enjoy that. You can get it on iTunes, and I'll link both Mighty Tom's Bible Study and Vision for the People in the show notes of this episode. So those are two ones I recommend. I've been a little bit slacking on the podcast lately. I put up a few movies recently. I guess I should probably play the audio from that movie, huh? Yeah, I should probably do that. I'm going to play the audio from the video that I just did about the Gilgamesh Flood before I play the Vision for the People radio interview. And this is one of the questions I've gotten a lot. It was about, well, what about the Gilgamesh, Epic of Gilgamesh flood story, and doesn't that disprove the Bible and everything else? So it was such a common thing that it was one of those that I just couldn't help but do a video about, and you can check that out on the YouTube site. By the way, my original YouTube site is back up. They agreed with me that the Michael Tesarian is wrong video is not infringing on copyright, and so they released it and gave it back up, but I only currently have two of the, I think, I can't remember how many, I think it was five videos that encompassed the Michael Tesarian is wrong on YouTube. But either way, I've got two of them up there on YouTube right now, and nobody is messing with them, so that is a good thing, and hopefully I can get back in the game as far as the 2012 search wars there and get that 2012 video back up where it was. It's got like 100 and some odd thousand views, and anyway, so that's the exciting thing. And so let's play that video real quick before we play the interview. Here we go. Many people will ask, what about the ancient accounts of a flood, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh? They say that these different accounts prove that the Bible plagiarized earlier stories. I am sometimes amused at this assertion, as the person saying them often doesn't realize that this is a case in favor of the Bible being true. And it is true that the Epic of Gilgamesh and others are very similar to the biblical account. In fact, there are quite a few more that I would like to add to the list before we get started. Legends have surfaced in hundreds of cultures throughout the world that tell of a huge, catastrophic flood that destroyed most of mankind, and that was survived only by a few individuals and animals. Although most historians who have studied this matter estimate that these legends number in the 200s, according to evolutionary geologist Robert Sosh, quote, Noah is but one tale in a worldwide collection of at least 500 flood myths, which are the most widespread of all ancient myths and therefore can be considered among the oldest. Sosh went on to observe, narratives of a mass inundation are found all over the world. Stories of a great deluge are found on every inhabited continent and among a great many different language and culture groups. Over a century ago, the famous Canadian geologist Sir William Dawson wrote about how the record of the flood, quote, is preserved in some of the oldest historical documents of several distinct races of men, and is indirectly corroborated by the whole tenor of the early history of most of the civilized races. Legends have been reported from nations such as China, Babylon, Mexico, Egypt, Sudan, Syria, Persia, India, Norway, Wales, Ireland, Indonesia, Romania, etc., composing a list that could go on for many pages. Although the vast number of such legends is surprising, the similarity between much of their content is equally amazing. James Perloff noted, "In 95% of the more than 200 flood legends, the flood was worldwide. In 88%, a certain family was favored. In 70%, survival was by means of a boat. In 67%, animals were also saved. In 66%, the flood was due to the wickedness of man. In 66%, the survivors had been forewarned. In 57%, they ended up on a mountain. And in 35%, birds were sent out from the boat. And in 9%, exactly 8 people were spared." What is the significance of the various flood legends? We have well over 200 flood legends, and possibly more than 500. Many of the legends come from different ages and civilizations that could not possibly have copied any of the similar legends. The legends were recorded long before any missionaries arrived to relate them to the Genesis account of Noah, and almost all civilizations have some sort of flood legend. The conclusion to be drawn from such facts is that in the distant past, there was a colossal flood that forever affected the history of all civilizations. Those living after the flood did not have the book of Genesis to read to their descendants. Genesis was not written until several hundred years after the flood. The account of the flood was passed on from one generation to the next. Many parents and grandparents told their children and grandchildren about the huge ark, the animals, the devastating flood, long before the Genesis record ever existed. Alfred Raywinkel wrote, "Traditions similar to this record are found among nearly all the nations and tribes of the human race, and this is as one would expect it to be. If that awful world catastrophe, as described in the Bible, actually happened, the existence of the flood traditions among the widely separated and primitive people is just what is to be expected." After the cultural trappings are stripped away from the kernel of truth in the various stories, there is almost complete agreement among practically all flood accounts. A universal destruction by water of the human race and all other living things occurred. B, an ark or boat was provided as the means of escape for some. And C, a seed of mankind was provided to perpetuate humanity. As Fulmer and Curley once observed, these traditions agree in too many vital points not to have originated from the same factual event. In Volume 3 of his multi-volume set, The Native Races of the Pacific Slope, H.H. Bancroft wrote, "There never was a myth without meaning. There is not one of these stories, no matter how silly or absurd, which was not founded on fact." So on the first point, this assertion that the ancient flood stories somehow challenged the biblical account is backwards. Ancient accounts of the flood are exactly what you would expect to find if the flood actually occurred, as are the various differences in the minor details that are observed. This, too, is what one would expect, like a game of telephone. The question then becomes, is the Genesis account more reliable? And if so, why? On the second point, I would like to address the issue of borrowing, since some claim that the accounts can be demonstrated to be written down before the book of Genesis, and that there is a chance that the writer of Genesis could have known about the Epic of Gilgamesh or another account and simply plagiarized it. Now, what is interesting about this assertion of dependence is that it is never asserted to be a literary dependence. All scholars agree that the differences in detail and content between Genesis and the Mesopotamian precursors are detrimental against it. Even scholars that do think the Hebrew accounts were dependent on the earlier Mesopotamian accounts are quick to point out that it is not literary dependence. Listen to these authors and remember that they are trying to prove that there is borrowing, but know that they cannot, from a scholarly, literary perspective, assert it. Quote, "The derivative nature of the biblical flood narrative, or rather the existence of an antecedent Mesopotamian tradition from the earlier forms of the biblical story, is undeniable. However, the extent to which the latter narrative is derived from the earlier tradition remains uncertain. A direct form of literary influence cannot be asserted, as the distinctive features of the representative narratives are too plentiful to allow such an affirmation. All one can say is that the biblical accounts must have been influenced by the Mesopotamian oral tradition or by a pre-existing series of such orally transmitted traditions." I would assert here that this is exactly what you would expect if such a flood really did happen. Another author asserts, "However, it has yet to be shown that there was borrowing, even indirectly. Differences between the Babylonian and the Hebrew traditions can be found in factual details of the flood narrative, from the ark, the duration of the flood, the identity of the birds and their dispatch, and are most obvious in the ethical and religious concepts of the whole of each composition. All who suspect or suggest borrowing by the Hebrews are compelled to admit large-scale revision, alteration, and reinterpretation in a fashion that cannot be substantiated for any other composition from the ancient Near East or in any other Hebrew writings. If there was borrowing, then it can have been extended only as far as the, quote, historical framework, and not included intention or interpretation. And another author states, it is obvious the differences are too great to encourage a belief in direct connection between Atrahasis and Genesis, but just as obviously there is some kind of involvement in the historical traditions generally of the two peoples. So basically, from a scholarly, literary perspective, there was no borrowing that can be demonstrated, and even the skeptics know this. For a very extensive scientific examination on the details of this assertion, please click on the description section of this video, where I will link some relevant information. Now to the final point, which is, if there are many accounts of this event from all over the world, why should we consider the one in Genesis to be more reliable from a historical perspective? And while there is a debate on which ones came first, we will assume, for the sake of argument, that the Mesopotamian accounts were first. The Epic of Gilgamesh and the biblical account of Noah's flood have a lot of similarities. This is no surprise, since they are both retelling the same event in history, most likely, a worldwide flood. But like thousands of flood legends around the world, the Gilgamesh story seems to have suffered from poor record-keeping. See if you can tell what's wrong. Let's take a look at each vessel. Here they are, drawn to scale, using the same cubit length of 0.5 meters. There is a good chance that the Gilgamesh storyteller got his icons confused. Rumor has it that a certain tower in Babylon was built on a square base. Yet some modern scholars want you to think that the Noah story grew out of the Babylonian mess-ups like this. The breadth-to-depth ratio is famous, of course. Everyone knows that 1.67 BD works very well and is quite normal for a cargo ship. This is an important factor for roll stability, but also has a bearing on the seakeeping. Increasing the width will provide even more stability, but at a cost. Roll accelerations can increase to uncomfortable and even dangerous levels. The length-to-depth ratio dominates the strength properties of the hull. Too long and shallow and the ship might break in half, due to the bending applied by the waves. The KRISO-based study indicated the 30-centimeter, or 12 inches, timber hull in a 40-centimeter structure would be sufficient for waves up to 30 meters high, which is a significant wave height. Noah's Ark has a very good proportion for a ship. Naval architects at the world-class KRISO facility conducted a study on Noah's Ark and found the vessel's proportions to be nearly optimal. The 6-to-1 length-to-breadth ratio is a little wider than today's vessels designed to move forward quickly, but it provides increased stability for a drifting vessel. A longer vessel has disadvantages for stability and seakeeping, as the U.S. Navy discovered. There is another factor that gives us confidence that the biblical account is historically reliable, namely its track record. It is my belief that God anticipated man asking, "How do we know if this book is from God? Why should we trust it?" And God basically decided to validate it by doing something that only God would be able to do. That is, write the history of the world in advance and never get a single detail wrong. That's right, and you might not hear this statistic from skeptics because they tend not to talk about it. But the Bible was about 25% prophecy at the time that it was written, and they were very specific prophecies about people, places, wars, empires that would come and how they would fall. Even specific names. This book claims to be the Word of God, and then it goes on to prove it. So, when asking if it can be trusted, I would ask you to challenge these claims. Thank you for your time. Alright, and you can watch all my movies at the two video sites now, youtube.com/nowheretorun1984 and youtube.com/knowheretorun1984. And, okay, so now let's play this interview from Vision for the People, and you can go to the website visionforthepeople.podomatic.com, and here we go.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the inaugural episode of Vision for the People. You can catch me on the web at www.youtube.com/user/DerekCollins79. That is D-E-R-E-K. And visionforthepeople.podomatic.com. I'm currently working on a host site for the show. I hope to launch that soon. If you Twitter, you can also find me there at twitter.com/ Derek Collins 79. And if you're listening and you're wondering what this show is all about, we're going to talk about politics, the occult, religion, the paranormal, entertainment, society and culture. We're going to talk about prophecy and faith, spiritual warfare. And the goal is to show everyone how these things are linked together, how they're all intertwined. We'll take a look back to ancient history. We'll look at what's going on now. And we're going to take a look at the imminent future. And the goal is to see the real world in focus. Tonight, my guest is Chris White from Nowhere to Run, which is a podcast that delves into a variety of topics, including conspiracy, the New World Order, religion, and Christian apologetics. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Chris.
Man, it is good to be here. I'm excited about this show, and I'm excited about everything you've been doing on the blog and everything. I'm just happy to be here, Derek.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself and where you've got to the point that you are now?
Well, I guess I'm just a regular guy. I live in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm 29 years old, about to be 30 here in about a month. And I have just always kind of been somebody that looked into a lot of interesting things, just a conspiracy theorist, I guess you could say. And that kind of led me in a lot of ways to a very similar thing that a lot of people are going through right now, which is really involved in the New Age. I wasn't really involved, but I definitely had those beliefs, mainly because, well, just a lot of different things. But that's where I was about 10 years ago or so, something like that. And then it was a very slow process of a lot of things once I, found out that there was deception there. It was a slow process of weeding out what was and what wasn't true. And then when I found the importance of Jesus and everything, then it really was also a gradual process of the Holy Spirit kind of guiding me and mainly just convicting me of a lot of stuff. And so I just wanted to tell more people about that. And just it seemed to come naturally in the context of showing people that they've been lied to. To tell people about Jesus, because the reason people were getting lied to was all centered around Jesus and the Bible. So that's kind of it was just a natural progression of things, and that's where I am right now.
So you were always into conspiracy?
Yeah, I remember being like this is a really weird early memory, but I do remember. Like in elementary school, I must have been in kindergarten, first grade or something like that. I don't know. But I remember it was when the Challenger blew up. And it was not when the Challenger blew up, but it was when the one after the Challenger, the next shuttle that went up. I remember telling some like fifth grader, I was like, whoa, this guy is like the oldest guy in the world. And I remember telling him like that, hey, if this one blows up, we'll know the Russians did it. And it's just a weird thing to remember. But I remember not getting that from anybody in my family or anything. I just like was just suspicious of things. But so I don't know. And I know that I don't think it's a really – I'm not terribly proud of that suspiciousness, I guess, because, there is a lot of deception in that too. But I think – but yeah, just to clarify the point, yeah, I guess I've always been a conspiracy theorist.
Well, I wasn't a conspiracy theorist. I actually laughed at the notion. But I do remember when I watched The Matrix, which has been one of my favorite films, thinking, what if the world that we live in now is not the real world? But like I said, I used to laugh at conspiracy, and for me, how I got into finding the truth, it was I'm on message boards and I click links and check out websites, and I came to a website and it has the video and you watch the video and it's Adam Weishaupt and the Federal Reserve, but right. It also leads directly to where you said you got into, not really getting into it, but a New Age type of movement. And I had experienced some certain things in my past, like the book and the documentary, The Secret. And it began to, for me, to question everything that I had been taught when I was little. And it was about questioning Jesus being real, or Jesus saying things that's taught in church, Gnosticism. So I can kind of relate to where you're coming from, although I never was into conspiracy. I pretty much laughed at it like a lot of people do now. But when you first started learning things that aren't mainstream, did you listen to what I call New World Order teachers that only gave you half truth?
Oh yeah, I definitely did. I probably didn't listen with any seriousness, not because of I didn't believe them or did not, or I, or whatever, to people like Jordan Maxwell, but Michael Tesori, and I heard enough of him, and Zachariah Sitchin, although he didn't really do a lot of that back then, he was one of the premier ones that got me into David Icke, even though not directly. But David Icke was probably, if any of them, the primary one that that I listened to, read his books, those kinds of things. It was mostly David Icke, which spun off to a lot of different things. He had a lot of information in his books about, you know, just about every kind of conspiracy. So at that point, it was a springboard for research, independent research, and other things. But that's definitely true in David Icke.
Well, for me, it was Jordan Maxwell that I got into that really led me to question what was real in my worldview. But I wonder, can we call this a certain thing mainstream truth movement? Because it seems to be a lot of the truth movement does leave out the most important thing about the truth movement.
Yeah, it's a lie movement. I mean, but it is mainstream truth movement. That's exactly what it is. It's like any other mainstream thing. It's actually a good term.
Can you explain to everybody listening how important it is to when you're listening to someone that is telling you that they're telling you the truth, how important it is to check their sources?
Well, it's the one thing that you can't slack on. I know it gets easy not to check your sources if you don't have really an incentive to do so. And I mean, all of us are guilty of it. I mean, is a lot of us kind of think, hey, if we're listening to somebody who says to check their sources, that's about as good as checking your sources. But if anybody's going to lie to you, they're going to tell you to check their sources on us. Hey, just check my sources. It all checks out. You can go like Zeitgeist as a classic example. Nobody ever checked those sources because, after all, there were the sources there in black and white. It's not that the sources weren't listed. It was that they were all totally I guess with the word problematic in each and every one of them. But anyway, it is important if you have something like a blog or a podcast or something like that, that usually, it, for me, it gave me an incentive to make sure that I was right. And even then, it's really hard to do because this whole thing is very murky waters where there's lots of truths and half-truths, et cetera. But if you're accountable, and I think this also could happen if you were just somebody who really was – really wanted to know the truth. In that case, like if you were somebody that was dedicated, if you were the type of personality that was dedicated to finding the truth, let's say about Jesus or something like that, like my roommate, he was really dedicated to finding out whether or not Jesus was the real religion, you know, and so for him, checking sources was absolutely paramount. And so if you're either want to be accountable for something that you're saying, or you just are a truth seeker, but it's absolutely necessary to make sure that you're right in this world.
Yeah, I think with the internet age, we have a great tool to finding out a lot of things, to finding out truth, to learning things that in the past we wouldn't have been able to learn. But I think also with that is the spread of disinformation, and it's very dangerous territories. I've been on boards and people can pull up 101 biblical contradictions and people can make a great argument and a great case. And if the message is something that they want to believe, it's easy to latch on to.
And, exactly.
And because of the age that we're in, you know, and I've been guilty of this, read something. The case sounds so good because people know how to put together arguments very well, even if they know they're being deceptive. And right. I think a lot of times we want to sit back and look at a case and say, it's not possible this person is lying because it's black and white. They just showed it to us.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. How do you, when you come across someone that, something you're listening to, somebody that's teaching, do you ever get to a level where you trust what somebody says? Or do you always?
Sure. I think that helps. Well, here's the main thing. I think once you kind of understand, like David Icke and, you know, really doesn't differ that much from Jordan Maxwell, Michael Cesarian, and even a lot of those that are getting it right out there, like Allwright, they don't really differ that much on certain areas, but you can find that they all differ, even amongst themselves, even those that, you know, hate Jesus, hate the Bible, they all don't even tell the same story about Jesus or the Bible. David Icke, for instance, kind of goes back and forth to whether or not he even existed. Same thing with, you know, Jordan Maxwell is kind of ambiguous as whether he existed or he was just allegory for the sun. Whereas, you know, you have somebody like, different ones that say he's a shaman or something like that, or, you know, whatever. They all have a different thing. So I guess what my point is that if you can consistently see that they're all lying about the Bible and Jesus, whether or not – doesn't really make it true. It just means that that's the issues that you know you have to check them out on. Like you mentioned, the 101 biblical contradictions and stuff like that. When that kind of stuff shows up, that's kind of in the context of, like – people just, you know, wanting to debunk the Bible or whatever. And my defense of that and the reason that I like to look those things up, and the reason that I'm totally confident in those circles of people challenging the Bible in that way is because of just repetition. And I mean that people – you know, I have encouraged people to send me their biblical things that they have wrong with the Bible, and sometimes they'll send me the 101 list. But, you know, oftentimes it's these three or four things that they really have, you know, problems with, whatever they are, general or specific. And if I haven't heard them, you know, I'll go look them up and maybe cross-reference them with a few apologetic sites or whatever and come with, what I think's going on there. And what I've found over the years is like Chuck Missler has said, that when you see a biblical contradiction or ostensive biblical contradiction, celebrate it, because just behind it lies a revelation just underneath the surface. And I found that to be absolutely true. And so after being hit with what seems like a deal breaker by these people and the way that they tell it, it only builds your faith when you find out the answer to that. And it's not like you don't have to, like, for an example of an example of what the problem is being solved by something that's even more awesome than the problem was bad. For instance, people will say that there's this one part in the Bible where pi, that is 3.14, et cetera, is that the Bible has pi wrong, and it's actually says it's 3.0. And they're talking about like this dish that Solomon made or whatever. There's two different ways to answer that, and I think probably both are applicable. One of them is that actually what's in question there is there's like an inner circle to this vessel and an outer circle, and that would account for it. But in addition, the word circumference with the gematria, I guess you could use it, plus is pi to the 17th digit with some calculation. So they wouldn't have even known pi to the 17th digit at that time, or actually up until very, very recently. So it's like the answer to it is so much better than the problem was bad in the first place. Anyway, that's a really long way to answer the question, but I guess the answer is essentially you can be sure that they're all stumbling over themselves over the Bible and Jesus, and so therefore it becomes the red flag every time they mention it. The other issues, while important, once you find out how important Jesus and the Bible really is to the actual battle against the New World Order, then that's what you're looking for to begin with.
I've personally found that looking at the antithesis to Christ and looking at the New World Order and looking at the Luciferianism in the world has actually given me greater faith. But I know there are people out there that are still questioning, that are still unsure, and I've been asked, you know, how do you know? Because there's so much information going around there. For every biblical contradiction, you can come back with an answer. For every argument from a biblical standpoint, somebody can come with a contradiction. For somebody that's just starting out, that is seeking sincerely the truth, where would you recommend that they would start from square one?
From, like, where would they be at?
For someone that's seeking the truth, that's unsure about the Bible, that's unsure.
Would they know anything about, like, conspiracy stuff, or would they just be totally American Idol?
Not totally American Idol. You know, I've talked to people that believe in ancient aliens theory. I've talked to people that wonder about what we would call or what mainstream would call mysteries that we know that aren't mysteries. Okay. And they're just unsure where to begin.
Well, basically, I would say to them that they are in the same boat that they were before, that this is all about what's true and what isn't true. And so you can investigate the claims, and they can be with the same diligence found out to be whether true or not true. I think that it's relatively easy to do that. I mean, and depending on where you start, I would say to start with for them. It depends on where they're at. Like I said, a lot of people will have different views about Jesus, because if they've gone to that point where they believe that, you know, aliens seeded mankind, et cetera, they have a version of Jesus and what he is. And so it really depends on where they're at. I know it's not a really good way to answer the question, but you'll find so much that it's so diversified about what somebody has done to them regarding Jesus, is that they have either relegated him to not existing or, you know, in a lot of ways, just, I think what's becoming more prominent as people get more into the New Age is this concept that, Jesus was just one of an avatar that comes every age, and he's just just like Krishna, et cetera, et cetera, which subtly is being, I think, promulgated because of the Christ consciousness concept that's going to be introduced as this part of this new Antichrist idea, the externalization of the hierarchy, which is a big word, but I think that's what that has to do with. I had another good point about that, which was eluding me right now. That basically, I guess I was just going to say that they don't have to have faith. A lot of people think that believing in Christianity is about faith. Well, in one sense, it is, but you have to understand what the Bible terms faith. It's not blind faith in something despite the evidence, because that's not logical and it's not what the Bible wants you to do. The kind of faith that the Bible talks about is the kind of faith that you would have in, like, your best friend ever, or, you know, a trusted parent or whatever, because you had seen them work so many times that it is that you have faith in them, that you have faith in them like your best friend, not blind faith in something that doesn't. That you have no, there's no evidence to believe in. That being said, I think God wants us to have faith that He can do what He says He can do. And once you recognize that the Bible is a collection of promises from God saying, "This is what I am and what I do," and these are the promises that I've made, and He validated that through prophecy, 25% of the Bible is prophecy at the time that it was written, and that is an unbelievable statistic when you start investigating those prophecies. And were they really written before the events happened? Can you demonstrate that? What were the events specific? You can go on and on and on about the existence of Jesus, if that's the thing, if somebody's told you that he didn't exist. There's a number of resources to prove for yourself whether or not this is or isn't true, and you should expect there to be a massive amount of disinformation in that regard. Because if what I'm saying is true, if Jesus really is the thing that they're really scared about, which we could talk about why, but if that's true, then you can expect there would be a great deal of effort put into discrediting him in every area.
Absolutely, and I think prophecy is really the selling point. It's what says that this is true. I am who I say I am. Because when you look to the book of Daniel and you have Daniel write and tell us the rise of Alexander the Great and his empire and its fall, it's just amazing to me. And Cyrus in the book of Isaiah is called out by name. 100 years before he's born?
Yeah.
And then told how he will conquer Babylon. So I think that's the selling point. But you know, people will pull up these sites, and it's a burden for me to see people accept untruth so easily. Although I realize that it happens all the time because of the message.
Right, and those sites. I mean, the way I kind of look at it is that anything that is unquestionably true will have an equal and opposite website out there saying that truth is not true because of some lame reason. And it's all – you can have the lamest reason to disprove anything that is unquestionably true, like in this case kind of talking about the details about, you know, some Bible issue or whatever. Like the other day I was looking up did Josephus actually say that Alexander the Great spared the city of Jerusalem because they had shown him the prophecies concerning his life? And while that – it is true, in my opinion. There are websites that just say, here is why that is such the lamest thing in the world. But it really requires an investigation to what, you know, a weighing of the facts. On one side you have this, on the other side you have that. That's what, you know, kind of what you were talking about is like, you know, really doing your research. That's where that comes in. Anticipating that there will be, you know, the opposite kind of feeling and then doing your own research.
How do you do your research, Chris?
Well, I guess just like anybody else, it really is a matter of being interested in something or having a reason to do it, and then just listening to both sides and weighing the evidence. And I don't really feel like I probably do a good enough job of determining whether or not I have it to a satisfactory degree of certainty or anything, because I probably don't. I just probably get it to a point where I feel comfortable with it for myself. And then, you know, you just got to deal with the consequences if you get it wrong or whatever. But, you know, I feel like it depends on what it is. I feel like a lot of times I'm real lazy in research, that I could have done a lot more. And, you know, I know that I draw a lot of off other people's stuff. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I do for the videos is, you know, just you know, getting stuff from other people's research and, you know, just doing the research as far as finding other research, you know. I feel that it's a work in progress.
Yeah, the more research I do, it seems like the rabbit hole just keeps getting deeper. Do you ever sit back and question reality?
I certainly used to question it a lot. Now I don't really question reality that much. There's certain aspects of things or whatever that I try to figure out. But really, I feel like reality is locked in now. I feel like that happened a while back. I remember when it happened. It was, you know, I was starting to get a lot of stuff figured out. I was starting to understand the things I didn't understand. The Nephilim thing started getting solidified down, and then I really started picking up with Joe Jordan and the research that he did, and, you know, about the importance of the name of Jesus in regards to a lot of the, you know, the quote-unquote alien abductions and things like that. And that snowball started going, and then I still had a lot of like stuff that wasn't making. I had a lot of feelings about Edgar Cayce, still thinking that there could have been some truth there, and a lot of anomalies like psychic power and these other issues that didn't quite make any sense to me. But right about the time that I found Zeph Daniel interviewing Russ Dizdar and those two guys, it really made a lot of those things, those anomalies, make sense, and all the. It seemed like all the systems in the world that were previously relegated to the just unknown supernatural were then not only understood, but then it made the Bible actually much more interesting, because it appeared that the Bible had known the true nature of reality the whole time. It was actually much more detailed, description of it than we ever guessed. And so I think that so I don't really question it, not because I don't question things, but because I feel a very strong peace in what reality is, and so it just makes the real work about what to do now that we've figured that out, and there's a lot to do.
I've said that over this last year that finding out what's really happening, what's really going on, is more entertaining than anything in the entertainment industry can offer. Today, I watched a movie called Knowing. And it's amazing to see little specks of truth within the entertainment industry. People will often question or ask, how do people come up with these ideas? And when you sit back and study what's really going on in the world, you can start to see where the people get their ideas, because it comes back to the same thread of truth somewhere. Although Hollywood will change and twist things and give you a different message than what the true one is.
Definitely. What did you think of the movie? Any particular thoughts right off the bat?
Serious fallen angel stuff in there. Another apocalyptic theme at the end. I don't want to give any spoilers away, but there is some serious conditioning about fallen angels, alien, UFOs, but right. That they are for good. I'll say
right.
That. Sure. They're coming back. They're coming here, but it's for a good reason.
Our benevolent space brothers. Yet another Hollywood benevolent space brothers movie. I've heard, it just absolutely perplexes me that anyone could possibly think that the UFOs or our space brothers concept could be hidden from the world, when every blockbuster movie since like I don't know what has been about that very same thing. I mean, how many just this summer? I mean, you know.
It does seem like it's more and more.
I do think
so. You know, it's increasing, and I think that is for a reason.
Everybody's primed and ready. You know, you're right. It doesn't necessarily have to be a slow thing. Just keep increasing them. It just has to be increased before the time that they're going to actually, you know, introduce the concept. It's like Bin Laden. Bin Laden had to be introduced into the concept, to the psyche of the world before 9/11, in the sense of like the Yemen bombing and all these things, and the constant pushing of them just at the right time through the media. Whether or not those things were real, which they very well could be, those precursor attacks, but the media did it in such a way that what I call the Bubba syndrome is, you know, Rick and Bubba the day of their radio station in Birmingham, Alabama, and they basically said, Bubba said to Rick, like, this seems like something that Bin Laden would do first day. And the only way that he could have really said this seems like something Bin Laden would do is if everybody was intended to have the knee-jerk reaction. If something like aliens ever goes down, then it has been the job of the media to make sure people have the necessary knee-jerk reaction to say, whatever it is that they are currently wanting us to do. Obviously, in this case, it would be to further a world government and a world religion, and to debunk Christianity, because if you look at like something like the movie Contact, which is with Jodie Foster, and how the Christians were the terrorists in that movie, and they were the enemies of the movie, and it had these very, you know, huge overtones in that. And that was very much the same kind of thing, because it, even though it's not true, you can see subtle hints that people think, because they've been programmed for this, and I mean that in the traditional sense of the word, by movies and by things like that, that if aliens are here, then that means Christians are wrong. And that is what the benefit of aliens are for the satanic deception, even though it's not true. Even if aliens existed in a very Star Trek way, they wouldn't disprove the Bible. The Bible is essentially silent on the fact, on the idea of whether or not there's life on other planets. It would do nothing to the Bible. But I'm telling you that these beings are talked about in the Bible, and they fit that description very accurately. But I'm sure we're preaching to the choir in that regard.
Do you think there's any particular reason in movies we see benevolent aliens and malevolent ones? And I've always said that, like, benevolent space brothers, why would anybody go out on a limb and say, because these beings have greater technology, that means that they're going to use them for good?
Well, you bring up an interesting point. Saying that they also bring up that they're bad in a lot of them too, and you see that angle taken in a great deal in a lot of things, and most of the good, New Age stuff has this kind of dichotomy of the good ones are fighting the bad ones, and the bad ones are sort of the good ones, and everybody has these like niche theories, and these people that think that they've been doing a lot of research are the ones that are going to tell you, it's like, well, not a lot of people know this, but the Greys are, you know, fighting the Pleiadians, and the Pleiadians like the reptilians, and the reptilians like the blah blah blah, and they got this whole like soap opera thing going on, which, you know, I'm not adverse to there being a certain degree of truth to that. But anyway, to answer your question, I think that the reason that they do that is because, I guess you kind of said, why must they necessarily be good, just because they have technology and things like that? Why paint them in a good light? And I think that painting them into a good light would, in my thinking, be the most beneficial for this new world order or whatever, because if a scenario occurred where man was in a serious war, these things could come back and say, hey, we seeded you, we created you through genetic modification, you guys are about to destroy yourself through this religious ideas that have got you guys fighting against each other, but that's all a mistake, you know, we're here to stop you guys, and this is all going to save you, and we're here to stop this madness, and all that kind of angle, which can create an instant world government with an instant world religion, and make the things in Revelation happen virtually overnight.
And I'm sure this is a question that people often ask in the truth movement, or people that are questioning reality. If the new world order is real, why are there teachers out there that are selling the new world order when they're a part of it? I mean, what's the point in that? You know.
Right.
I have this theory, you know, that I've been tossing around. I like the Alex Jones channel. People will listen to Alex Jones. I've listened to Alex Jones before. There's a lot of sensationalism. There's a lot of propaganda there. There are people that question Alex Jones, whether he's part of what's going on. And people may ask, well, if Alex Jones is part of it, then why is he out there teaching it? And I got this theory that I look at what's going on in our country, and if you listen to some people, they can get you riled up pretty easily, and they can get you thinking about revolution. And my theory is that maybe in this country, that's what they want to do, to have a means for martial law, to stir people up. And I was looking at an article just a couple of days ago, from deprogram.net, that was mentioning a lot of the gun sales have increased, that the street cops are actually getting scared about what they're hearing
on the streets?
Well, I think that if what is happening with the New World Order is in fact true, then there would naturally be a very good opposition to it. It being evil, that is the New World Order, and doing evil things for evil reasons. So there would be a natural resistance to it. What I think we see happening with some people is controlled opposition and recognizing that there must be opposition and that there will be folks that are intending to resist, and just becoming those people and for the people, for the reason of, well, there's lots of reasons to do that. I mean, traditionally, you know, in wartime and stuff, it has been to, you know, be in a position to get all the good information about what's really being set up, you know. I don't think that Alex Jones is a part of that. I think that Alex does unintentionally serve a lot of that. But at the same time, Alex has done so much to get people to the train station, as I've said before. And I think that in that way, I think certain people just don't have a chance until they get to the train station. I mean, otherwise they're just going to be blindly following anything to certain doom as this whole thing gets rolling. You know, there's going to be vaccines that'll probably just put you out of who knows what, you know, and whatever, any myriad of things that could be wrong. But I see what you're saying, and I think that what the thing is that they're going to use, like, the idea of, hey, like to the cops, let's say. The cops have, in fact, been hearing that, hey, do you know these domestic people, these 9/11 truthers, et cetera, you know, they're all hate cops, and they're the real enemy, and the new Al-Qaeda, and whatever. They've had they didn't really need anybody to do anything, but they have that kind of mindset being subtly told to them. And when something happens, let's say an economic collapse, which is all that really needs to happen in order to facilitate the martial law kind of issue with riots all over. Let's say if the dollar crashed or some variance of that, California decided it really, I mean, which it was going to happen unless some multinational group can give them a loan or something like that. You know, there's going to be people who can't pay the state employees, can't pay the schools, nobody goes to school, riots in the streets, that kind of thing. Then people can, then the New World Order, as it were, can start doing things like taking people to camps and to controlling riots, you know, and doing these kinds of things all for the good of the public and the safety, and get people used to the idea of people getting taken to camps and, you know, that citizens can be taken these places and whatever. So excuse me, they don't really need a 9/11 truther to put a pipe bomb in the whatever, which they very well might do. I mean, I could see it being a part of all this. I mean, it could be that go that way. But they don't need it because they just need chaos. And once they get the chaos, they can show everybody who's boss. And once they do that, then everybody will start acquiescing as the chaos turns to order. And the order is what we really should be afraid of.
And you did mention vaccines, and of course that goes along with chaos too. We got this swine flu pandemic going on. Can you tell everybody about your Hendersonville Vaccine Awareness Clinic? Because that looks like something that could be very important coming this fall.
Well, it's not a clinic per se. It's just a website. It's called the Hendersonville Vaccine Awareness Network. And basically what it is just a site that me and a friend started that basically put together a lot of information and research about vaccines for our local area, and we showed the local state laws and things. It shows it was relatively easy to get out of giving the vaccines after they had learned all the stuff, and once you go through the information, if you have any question right now, you're thinking, okay, this guy is crazy. We should have vaccines. Everybody knows that. I've heard it for so long. Just try me on this one. Go to HendersonvilleVaccineAwarenessNetwork.com, the longest website in the history of the world, and see what you think, because there's enough peer-reviewed research from doctors, more doctors than you'll ever see written in one place, and they are all unanimous in that this is a terrible idea that isn't backed up, has no long-term research,
and that is knowingly doing a lot of very dangerous things. Certain things like, you know, crib death and shaken baby syndrome and sudden infant death syndrome. These kind of things happen right after vaccines, but all of a sudden, you know, they don't know where what causes them, yet they started when vaccines were given to babies at that age. And, you know, they give them the most – there are unbelievably bad things that are going down with the vaccine thing. So, yeah, that's just something I would encourage other people to do too. Make people aware of that situation if they know somebody with a baby right now. And I know it's hard to say, well, yeah, but the doctors all really want me to do it. Just don't do it. Just tell them you're not going to do it. Right now, we still have the option. But
yeah, I wanted to give some listeners just some facts about this that will at least raise some questions. Today, we had our first death from swine flu in Georgia. Of course, that was on the web. 13WMAZ.com. But the WHO, the World Health Organization, called the H1N1 swine flu a pandemic on June 11th. But here's some facts about it. As of July the 10th, there was 211 people in the continental United States that had died from it. And there were just over 37,000 cases. The regular flu that we get every year, 36,000 people die a year on average. But the U.S. has already allocated $350 million to fight swine flu this fall. And I was reading an article today. Let's see if I can pull it up. Yeah, in the New York Times. But it was from July the 9th. It says Obama warns of return of swine flu in the fall. The potential for a significant outbreak in the fall is looming. President Obama said by telephone link from Italy to the White House's H1N1 influenza preparedness summit held at the National Institutes of Health. With good planning, we may end up averting a crisis, Mr. Obama said. That's our fervent hope. And it's going around that I've heard, you know, talk that the schools may be getting this. And this is maybe something they want to do that mandatorily at schools. And what can we do? And then what can the parents do out there? Is there anything we can do to say no? What if they say that, you know, your kid's got to get this vaccination or they can't come to school?
Well, they would have to change some laws in order for this to be much different. That's what they essentially say now, that you have to get the vaccines or you can't come to school. But what they don't tell you is that you can ask for this little sheet. Well, it's not quite that simple, but it is in some places. Most states have about three ways you can get out of the vaccine. Religious exemption. Some of them, not including Tennessee, has philosophic exemption, and then a medical exemption. Some of them are just as easy. If you have like a medical exemption, you can just get a note from a doctor that's sympathetic to the cause, and they're easier and easier to find. And in fact, the biggest response we had from the Hendersonville Vaccine Awareness Network were from doctors locally that were fully aware of all the research that we had. Anyway, so I would say check your state laws. I would have that kind of thing on the ready. If you understand how dangerous they are, you owe it to your kids, because you could come back and they could never – I mean, it depends on how young they are. I mean, they're at risk for a lot of different things. But there's a religious exemption where I think every state has a religious exemption where you just – essentially you do have to actually be able to defend it. And it's really not that hard to defend. There's a few different things. Most vaccines have aborted fetus tissue in it, and so that's a good way to do that, in that you obviously don't want to inject aborted fetuses into your body. And then the other one is that it's using and crossing certain genes that aren't supposed to be crossed. There's some Bible verses that essentially says not to mix that situation or whatever. So those are usually cited. But anyway, so those are the two that I know of. I think there's some information about that there too. But there's lots of creative ways you could probably get into the religious exemption category too.
What do you think's going on with this H1N1 pandemic? What do you think is happening behind the scenes?
Well, I don't know. I think that there was this big thing back in the 70s of H1 or the swine flu. They had a huge propaganda campaign, same situation. Hey, have you got your swine flu shot? I mean, they really, really did it up there. And again, it was kind of just this nothing kind of issue. I've heard some talk that it was a lot of beta test kind of thing, maybe to get some data about how things spread and this kind of thing. I also heard some issues about it being something that could mutate later on. I haven't looked into a lot of that stuff, but I have heard it from very reputable sources that there was something that was going on with it specifically that would actually either cause some damage later or begin to make the virus itself more dangerous somehow. So I think if nothing else, if no conspiracies are going on there that can be brought out in truth, then I would say that the main thing it's going to do is do, like you said, fund huge blocks of money to vaccine people that get to force vaccines on people, and then at that point, and change the laws regarding vaccines, like I said, about the schools, if something like that happens, then that's the main thing. If they can change the laws, then it doesn't matter if it's the swine flu or the cheetah flu. Whatever the next thing is, they've got the laws in place to make it happen. And if they finally get a vaccine, that they're just – this is the end game for this kind of issues. It's not – I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that. There's two things. One of them is the – surely, if they could get a nice virus that could kill off a lot of people, they probably would do it and call it genocide and think it was a good thing. But I firmly believe that the biggest thing that they're trying to do is to vaccinate everybody. If they need a mandate to vaccinate everyone and they can do it with a virus that is so deadly that it becomes a no-brainer for people. Everybody would have to get vaccinated, and if they get to do that, then first of all, who knows what they're going to put in that vaccine? And then second of all, they get to change all the laws, and they get to make anybody who didn't get a vaccine the biggest pariah on the planet. Can't get a job, show me your papers, mm-hmm. can't cross this border, can't do that. It turns into a police state all based on the flu issue. So it's not a non-issue. It's the issue in a lot of different ways.
Possible quarantine.
Oh yeah, the quarantine centers and everything else. I mean, it all starts with a outbreak, I think, or I don't know. I mean, I don't know. It's one possible scenario. I think probably one of the more likely ones. But I would also say not to be too worried about that, because I mean, if you're in Christ, then you don't have that to worry about. And that doesn't mean that you should just sit back and not do anything. But it does mean that you know, that He is way bigger than all this stuff, and that it does make what's important is not saving your butt. It's essentially saving your neighbor's butt or soul. Let's exchange soul for butt there. And that's what I mean.
I heard something interesting today. Going back to swine flu, I was listening to PID radio and just happened to hear them talking about the Marburg epidemic in Angola. A few years back, and they said the aid workers were going over there and the people were attacking the aid workers because they said that this virus first started through vaccinations and that the people they were vaccinating were the children. And I just thought that was kind of looking like what might be happening here, not to say that it is, but
Well, it would be, yeah, I mean, definitely. The children are obviously vaccinated, at least for political correct reasons, that they can, because they've told everybody that that's who needs to get the flu shot, and the elderly need to get the flu shot, which is causing Alzheimer's disease and is causing autism, because the flu shots are the one thing that mercury hasn't been taken out of, that is thimerosal. There's lots of reasons to be scared of vaccines, but thimerosal is certainly one of them, and it's causing, in my opinion, Alzheimer's, and it's causing autism, and it takes a while. One of the most highly publicized doctor in the world at the time, I'm probably saying it wrong, but basically he has more peer-reviewed material in medical journals than any other doctor, did a study on what happens if if somebody goes to get a flu shot essentially 10 times, I think their percentage of getting Alzheimer's was so like 75% increased or something like that.
Wow.
So it was about as conclusive study as you can get saying that it was causing it him obviously knowing it was a very sensitive issue and very politically incorrect. And now he's been totally smeared for that. This very reputable doctor has these just lame smears out there saying that he was a drug addict and all these things, that he was writing prescriptions for himself and all this stuff. And you can look into what they were saying that he wrote the prescriptions of. And it's like for totally painkiller issues. But the way they wrote the articles, it seems like, oh, this guy is such a druggie. But
you think that's a red flag for people to examine closer when someone's getting attacked?
Definitely. I mean, if you, like I said before, if anything is true, you're gonna have the equal website thing. It's same thing as like in the Christian world too. If somebody's saying something that is good doctrine, you will have somebody calling it false doctrine out there.
Yeah.
There will be a website called somebody is false, doing some false teaching, you know, which, you know, and there are a lot of that actually is going on, but I'm just saying.
Was there anything else that you wanted to talk about?
Well, just that in all this stuff, I think that people might want to consider – If you feel like you've gotten a handle on all this stuff and you weren't too shocked by anything that we were talking about today, then you probably got a lot of it figured out. And honestly, there's not a whole lot more to know. I'm sure there's details and things like that. But there is this incredibly deep field of bettering our spiritual walk with God. I mean, when Jesus Christ died, he died to reconcile us to God. He died to give us an audience to the throne room of the universe. And I think that we should spend our time wisely in prayer, asking for the things that we need in our physical lives, but also understanding that we are eternal lives, are eternal, and that we should ask for the things that we need to begin to grow and learn as eternal beings, and ask God to give us things like humility and whatever it may be, courage or whatever you lack in that way to become more like Jesus. And that's the goal, not just for this life, but for the next life too. And also to recognize that evangelism or discipleship or, you know, whatever edifying of the body of Christ or the future body of Christ, in the evangelism anyway, is whatever degree that you think that is your lot. It might not be handing tracts out on the street. It might not be making videos or doing podcasts. It might not be anything like that. But maybe it is just talking to that one guy that you have a burden for and finally doing it, you know. And or maybe it's whatever it is. But I would encourage everyone to consider stepping out of their comfort zone, because the whole Bible is about stepping out of their comfort zone. And I'll tell you, God's power, if you feel like, hey, you know, God's not around, you know, seems like sometimes he's distant or whatever, it's not him that moved, you know. And I've been taught that really recently. This had not necessarily to do with evangelism, but it, out of what I figured out, evangelism grew out of it, which was that I kind of had this point where, you know, God had just blessed me with all kinds of stuff, and I was like, you know, not stuff, but I was like in a good place and I felt like I was being really taken care of and stuff. And I was kind of in that comfortableness, had drifted away just slightly, and not to any kind of falling away situation, which, you know, I mean, I'm sure that can happen too, but I mean, it wasn't anything like that. It was just, you know, I just didn't feel the closeness that I normally do. And I started thinking about it, and I knew all the cliche answers were, well, you know, you need to pray more, or you need to read the Bible. And so I would have said that to somebody else in a very cliche way, but I was like, okay, well, let's really do that and dedicate to some time to prayer and some time to reading the Bible. And I got to tell you, that is not just a cliche, but that's where it is. It's like God said, you know, seek me and you'll find me. And so I think that he rewards the diligent in and his being reconciled to him is so great once you begin to know him and trust him that it's life is full of peace and power and joy and love in his protection. It's like the keys to the universe are given to the person who in humility asks God for it, as opposed to thinking that he himself is how it is attained.
And once you've experienced the personal relationship, nobody can tell you it's not real.
Exactly. I mean, that's kind of the deal, the thing at the end of the day. You know, I talked to some people that were really strong in Christ before they saw some of these, you know, horrible movies that just lie so heavily about them, and that would make any other person just throw it all away if they weren't strong in Christ. But how could you tell somebody that knows what the presence of Jesus is like that he's not real? It just doesn't even make any sense. It's like, well, that made a good case, but it's not true. I mean, there's nothing that can shake a faith of somebody that knows Jesus, and knowing Jesus is something that is there for the asking.
Well, Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Hey, man, it's been a pleasure to be here. I got to say, this is the best interview that I've ever done, ever. You did a absolutely fantastic and uniquely fantastic job at it, and I hope that you do a lot more and do a lot soon, because a lot of people need exactly what you are willing to shell out.
I appreciate those words, Chris. I'll link everybody to Chris's websites. He has several of them out there, very good resources. Check him out. His main site is nowheretorunradio.com, and you guys give him a shout. I've learned a lot from Chris. He's inspired me to do what I'm doing now, and if you're out there thinking, hey, who am I? I can't do anything, don't think that. Every person can make a difference.
Right on.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Good night.
Good night.